Jesus Christ made a powerful statement regarding the church. We read in Matthew 16:18, when Christ said, "I will build my church, and the gates of Hades," or the grave, "will not prevail or overpower it." On the day of Pentecost 31 AD, we read of the dramatic events that occurred on that day in Acts 2, and Christ beginning to build his church, and the Holy Spirit being given to those who heard the gospel preached, and they believed and repented. With the foundation of the apostles whom Christ had personally taught, the church begins in a very powerful way. The New Testament church begins in a very powerful way. We read in Revelation 2 and 3, and we see a time at the end, and God's church is still there at the end of the age. We also read in Revelation 12, the church at the end of the age, and we see depicted that Satan himself does everything to destroy the church, but fails. We see this symbolically described at the end of Revelation 12, where a church is depicted as a woman and a devil persecuting the woman, and yet the woman is able to escape. Christ will build his church, and it will have its difficult times. But the church, with its head as Christ, from the time of Pentecost, 31 AD, to the very end of this age, when Christ returns, will not cease to exist. In 1 Timothy 3:15, we read, "The church of the living God is the pillar and ground of the truth, and despite the wrath of Satan, he will not prevail against the church." The gates of Hades or the grave will not prevail against it. The church will prevail because the church is precious to Jesus Christ, the head of the church. Ephesians 5, verse 23 says, Jesus is the Savior of the body, of the church. A few verses later, we read that Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. The church is special to God and Christ. The church, the first fruits of his spiritual harvest and bringing many sons and daughters to glory, are very special to God. But what is the purpose of the church? What is the purpose of the church? We'll discuss the church's awesome purpose over the next few Sabbaths, and especially on the Pentecost. Christ's own promise to build the church is for a reason. Today, we're going to cover a purpose that we may not immediately think of, or at least the way we'll cover it today. One purpose is for God, is for God to show his wisdom in this age, in action, being demonstrated. Today we'll cover what that wisdom is and to know whom is the wisdom being shown to. Who is it being shown to? So the title of today's sermon is "The Manifold Wisdom of God Made Known by the Church." So let's go to the epistle, as some call the epistle to the church. God inspired Paul in the most elegant language to write about the spiritual church in Ephesians. And we covered that in our monthly Bible studies on the first of the month. But let's go to Ephesians 3, and we'll begin to read in verse 8. So let's go to Ephesians 3. If you have your Bibles, and we'll start in verse 8. Ephesians 3, verse 8. And Paul writes this, "To me, who am less than the least of all the saints, this grace was given that I should preach among the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to make all see what is the fellowship of the mystery, which from the beginning of the ages has been hidden in God, who created all things through Jesus Christ." verse 10, to the intent that now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known by the church to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. This is an astounding scripture when we might just read over it, because there's some very lovely words in the way it's expressed, and Paul's expressing himself in sort of very elegant terms. But this is an astounding scripture that we might just possibly read over, and there's a lot packed in here. If we break it down into the pieces or parts, we'll see some amazing statements being made by Paul and regarding the church. The church, or in Greek, the ecclesia, the called out ones. The called out ones from this world to God. Being called out means being called out of the philosophy or false ideas and into God's church, into the body, into God's truth, calling to God's truth. Now let's focus now on verse 10 and break this down into three distinct parts so we really understand what's being said here. Verse 10, let me read it again to you. That now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known by the church to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. So let's look at this first section here, this first part. Part one, we'll say, the manifold wisdom of God. Now, manifold, at least I don't use that word very often. And when I hear manifold, I think of something to do with an engine, something that goes on the engine. And those that are engine guys probably know what a manifold is. So that's what I think of. Here, let me give you another translation. The multifaceted wisdom of God. The multifaceted wisdom of God. Barnes' commentary describes it like as this. The multifaceted wisdom of God as a prism of light that has so many gradients of color. It's like when you have a light going through a crystal and light shines on it, and through that, there's many different gradients or shades or dimensions of color that come out when the crystal turns. It's multifaceted. You can kind of visualize that in your mind. God's wisdom is truly multifaceted. Like light through a crystal, you might say, that brings out different colors, and it moves a little bit different. You see another aspect of the light going through the crystal. A bit later, we'll look at where God's wisdom is described and see different aspects of God's wisdom. But let's go to the next part, or the next piece of what we just read, and we'll break that down. It says, the manifold wisdom of God, which we just read, might be known by the church. Might be known by the church. So who should be made known the multifaceted wisdom of God? The church. The called out ones, the ecclesia, the body of Christ. The spiritual body of believers who have been called out from this world to God. The church is to know what the wisdom of God is. The wisdom of God, the ability to understand and apply and live by God's ways and instructions that represents God's wisdom. Another way of saying this is understanding God's laws and applying them with results that have peace, harmony, justice, and is based on love and care for others, outward care, outward concern, sacrifice for others. The wisdom of God is made known to whom? Who is it made known whom to? Your neighbors? Well, it's possible that your neighbors may detect something is different about you if you have this love and care and the wisdom of God living in your life or your neighbors or the world or the work colleagues. But I'd say the world's not recognizing the church for the wisdom of God. No one's like, oh, you know, here we are, Northwest Indiana, the wisdom of God just flowing out. The world is not even paying attention to that. That's not how they're operating. So to whom is this wisdom being demonstrated to? Well, that's what Paul writes next. To principalities and powers in the heavenly places. To principalities and powers in the heavenly places. Paul uses a very similar phrase in Ephesians 6, starting in verse 10. Let's turn there. Keep your fingers in Ephesians 3 there. Let's go to chapter 6 and read in verse 10 through 11 and 12. Paul writes here in verse 10, we'll pick it up in chapter 6. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might, but put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts or armies of wickedness in heavenly places. Now, go back to Ephesians 3, where we started out. We can see that through the church, the wisdom of God in its rich variety, multifaceted way of looking at it, when we understand it, might be known to the rulers and authorities in heavenly places. Now, why is the wisdom of God being made known by the church to principalities and powers in heavenly places? That's an interesting question to ponder. Paul doesn't say, as I mentioned before, to demonstrate to the world we live in, through the church be made known the wisdom of God. You know, again, as we come in contact with different people, they may detect something's different about the church. There's a way, you know, we've gone to feast sites, and people that own the buildings, the restaurants that we may be part of, they detect that we're very enjoyable to work with, we're peaceable. There's something that they detect is much easier. So there is that effect, but it's really, as a whole, you know, they're ignorant of the wisdom of God being shown through the church. Paul's statement is instructive, if we pause to think about it. There is another unseen spiritual realm that we don't physically see, but it's very real, very, very real. What did Paul say? Our struggles, our wrestling, you might say, the wrestling matches that we get into sometimes, it feels like we're in a wrestling match at work or school or something going on, and we're just like, you know, and that we get entangled in those sometimes. It isn't with flesh and blood. It says against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts or armies of wickedness in heavenly places. That's who we're wrestling with, this unseen world, and it's very real, very real. You know, I just will tell you a quick story about a lady who called me up, wasn't in the church. She just called me a few weeks ago. And she was having some extreme difficulties with demonic forces in her house, in her life. And she told me how that she said she opened the door. Certain things occurring in her life, she did. And now she's trying to get, you know, we never have to worry about demonic forces. You know, God protects us in that way. But the attitudes, the emotions, the things that we sometimes wrestle with, you know, it's a spiritual realm out there that we're dealing with, attitudes, things that we have to deal with. Now, we see an insight to this when we look at the book of Job. Who was Job wrestling with in attitudes? You know, he was dealing with some very difficult situations. Who was he wrestling with? You know, was Job wrestling with the arguments of his three friends? Or unseen attitudes or arguments being presented to them that he had to respond to. And, you know, God wasn't pleased with their answers. If you look at what they were saying to him, it might look like flesh and blood, but the attitudes, the arguments that were being presented to Job, he was wrestling with a spiritual attitude that was being presented to him. And what was the main accusation against that Satan made against Job? Now, if you think of it this kind of, what was the main accusation? There's an accusation made against Job to God. We read it in Job 1:9. Let me read it to you. He just comes out and says, does Job fear God for nothing? Does Job fear God for nothing? And that was really an accusation against God more than Job. It was an accusation. And really what's behind it, if you think about it, is an attitude, a accusation that says, the only way, tells you a little bit how Satan thinks, the only way mankind, your creation, you know, people made in your own image, were ever going to follow you and do what you say and truly love you if you give them something in return, you know. And God promises many things to us. He truly does. I'm not saying that's the truth, but there's an accusation that's like, well, Job's only doing this because he can get something out of it. And that gets to the core of what is our motivation and our relationship with God. Job went through a very difficult time, a massive trial, very, very, very difficult, trial recorded for us. And through it all, he had questions. But if you go through it, he never turns against God. He never turns against God, does he? He had questions. He didn't understand everything. And really, the answer that Satan proposed, that put out there, or the question he put out there, the accusation, well, Job only does things because he's only righteous because he gets things in return. Well, in a way, that the book of Job answers that question. Job never turned against God, even through a difficult trial. And it really brings to light, there's really two philosophies. Two philosophies, only two ways. God's way, the love, God of love, the give way, as we've described it, the give way, outward thinking of others, a selfless thinking of others. And the other one that Satan has developed, the way of get. Selfishness, in it for yourself, thinking about yourself first, who's number one. There's really only two ways, the way you get and the way you give, as we've heard it described. Satan, when he was Lucifer, represented God's government on earth. But over maybe millions of years, or however time was managed in the spirit world, he developed what he thought was a better way. Better wisdom that could result in something better. A philosophy that we see prevalent today. And at the core is that the selfish thinking of yourself manifested through the way of competition produces better results. Competition is fueled or motivated by greed, lust, envy, pride, covetousness. The way of competition. To help us understand this, I wanted to recap what I might say is an illustration that I heard Dr. Hay tell in a sermon that's now over 35 years old. Now, I don't know, most of you, a few of you may not know who Dr. Hay was, but he was, you know, back in the late 47, he was the intellectual, highly intellectual, smart individual that God, I believe, brought into the church to help support Mr. Armstrong in research and understanding certain things that are of technical nature. He was an evangelist and used in many different ways to help preach the gospel. But he recounted in a sermon that's now over 35 years old, this conversation. He had a conversation with a man who had an unclean spirit, a demon, who wanted to come talk to him. And he recounts the conversation. He goes, and he says, he wanted this strange request of wanted, he wanted, this man came, really the spirit came to him and said, this unclean spirit, this demon came to him and said, he wanted to ask Dr. Hay, what was his advice, or could he help in getting God to change his mind? And the spirit went on to explain to Dr. Hay that they thought that their way was better. He goes back and went back and he recounted like the mindset that they went through, the spirit, people that turned from angels to demons and Satan hopefully inspired. They thought there was a better way. And better than God's way. And the bottom line of it was they felt that cooperation was a problem. When you cooperate and you work together and everybody's working together in a godly way, they had a problem with that. And it was that the weak are able to survive and thrive and be taken care of. And that was their problem. And he said, and he told Dr. A, the competition brings out the best. Ultimately, brings out the best. Who's going to be the best? And Dr. Hay went on to make, you know, in telling a story from the Sturm, and he made the insight that the underlying idea is that competition shows who is the most important. Think about it. That's the underlying thing about who is the most important? Who's number one? Who is at the top? And if you know who the number one in person is, you remember, who in sports or any number of things, we rarely, rarely remember who came in second place or third place. It's always first place. And it could be sometimes fractions of a second difference or little things like that. But we always, and he went on to contrast that, you know, that's really what the ultimate goal is. Who is the most important? And this spirit that came to him wanted to know how to get God to change his mind so that the other angels would join them. And that's sort of right. This is the way to go. So it's a very interesting story. I mean, you know, and he was, so it's the most interesting story he had. And he was just relaying it in the sense of how the mind of Satan works, the spirit, the evil spirit realm, the principalities of darkness think, you know, this idea of competition, the get wave, of wanting something from greed and covetousness and lust, and you go after it with all your might, and despite, you know, who you might hurt along the way. So are there principalities and powers in heavenly realms? Yes, there is. And if we pause to consider it, just think about it for a moment, what is this world, this society built on? It's built on competition. And we have different things like the arms race. You know, it kind of died down for a while, but we have the arms race between the nations. Who has the most devastating weapon? Or the most devastating weapons? And whoever has the most has a leverage against the other nations in diplomacy. And it'd be the most dominant. We see some of those things happening today in the world around us. We see nations starting to vie for who's the most dominant based on military might. And there is a military race on right this moment. And that should tell you what's the motivation behind that. We have economic competition at all levels, all levels. And ultimately, it tells us who is the most important. If you have the most economic power, then you can dominate or be more important than another country, another nation, another company, whatever it may be. Remember the golden rule, the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And that's really the way, in many ways, the way it works. He who has the gold, you might say the gold and the military, makes the rules. And you see that. If you look back in history of the world, the nation, the kingdoms, the empires that had the most wealth, which usually meant they had the biggest armies, what did they do? They made the rules. They set the terms of peace. They set the terms of diplomacy. They set the terms of how the trade was going to go. And always the ones with that in that position made terms very favorable for them. And so they could keep, and you see that, just study any empire that was around, and that's the way it works. He who has the gold makes the rules. And that's the reality. That's the reality of the age we live in. We have competition in every form. And does it produce certain results or advancement? Does it produce, you know, result in advancement or results? Or it does. It does. But it comes with a big downside, doesn't it? A big price to pay for many in this age. How many have unhappiness, sorrow, and there's many tears in this world with the advancements that we see, the things that are going forward technology-wise. You know, as we used to say, you know, there's massive, incredible things that man's been able to produce, yet massive sorrow, massive, terrible things going on at the same time. And that's the problem, that everybody suffers in this way of get. There's a few that maybe get the advantage or get to have some upside for some amount of time, but it's the way of get. The way of get. Get philosophy has its very, very many downsides. And if we analyze it, there's really strife. And there's very little peace in this philosophy. There's always this tension when there's this way of competition or being dominant or being one up on everybody else, whatever it may be, however it may manifest itself. And that creates strife and it leads to wars, it creates unhappiness, creates all certain things, and does not lead to peace in this philosophy. We see very little peace in this world today. And yet we have more knowledge than ever before. Now, how is that? We have knowledge but no peace. Not real peace. Something is not working in this world. Something is not working in this world. Contrast that to what we have called the give way. The give way. And which is thinking about others. Esteeming others higher than yourself. Thinking of others, not being self-oriented, but outward thinking of others. Competition is glorified in almost every arena of our society. Businesses compete. And because of this, we do have better products. You know, people compete to have a better product, a better service, whatever it may be. And many times it's products we love. Many of them we have. You know, we're like, oh, you know, we have our laptops or phones and things that are better than they were 6 months ago, better than they were a year ago because of competition. And these are all at our fingertips, because what is produced? It all comes from competition. And that's really, you know, basically our free market society is based on competition. And it's lauded. And, you know, it's how our economy works. The best companies survive and we benefit from better products, services is the theory. And almost every segment of society, the underlying thought is competition brings out the best. And we all benefit. But do we? If we analyze this philosophy when it's drawn out the very last moments of this philosophy, the results are, and we have this in, and we see this in Revelation, the results are that God ultimately has to step in and save humanity from itself. That's the end result. You know, this idea, this philosophy, and we'll see the world play out that way. This way of operating is, and we should think about this way of operating, this philosophy is so ingrained in our psyche. We were born into it. You know, we're actually born into it. But God has called us out of it and to Him. I think all of us, even though every year, you know, many of us here have gone to the Feast of Tabernacles for decades and decades, and we talk about the millennium and how it's going to be different. And how it's going to be so much better. There's peace and harmony and prosperity and abundance and all these wonderful things based on the giveaway, cooperation, and God's laws being applied the right way. And governance, service-based governance. And we see the results. We talk about the results at the feast. And again, a time of true abundance and peace. Wonderful blessings. We talk about that and we go to the feast as a foretaste of that time. But I think even for us, if we've gone to the feast and we know it's going to be different, we're really going to be truly amazed at just how different it's going to be. The way of cooperation being there, loving your neighbor as yourself by everybody. Everybody's practicing loving your neighbor as yourself or being taught to anyway. The give way of life, how to take care of others. And we will see, you know, I just think we should stop for a moment. How much even in our own lives in Western society is ingrained to us that competition produces the best. And that's the world we live in. We have to go out and live in it. We have to, you know, sort of be a part of that in our workplaces or wherever. But I think we're going to be amazed, even ourselves are amazed at how different it's going to be in the millennium. Just how productive it's going to be, you know, and it's almost like we might even have our own sort of, you know, we're working our own mindset right now to be different and with God's spirit working in us and God's laws being written on our hearts and in our minds. But even though we've never seen really other than maybe very small moments, maybe of everybody working that we see at the feast, we see it in congregations, we're seeing in the whole world operate that way. Being taught that way. So it takes some time, but taught that way. I think even we will be just massively shocked of how society is going to operate so different from today. Because we've got it ingrained in our mind, you know, how in certain things in our mind from living in this Western world. But the Bible talks about two wisdoms. It talks about two wisdoms. Let's review these two wisdoms and understand and be able to identify the differences. We should be able to identify the differences. What's different? Those called out with God's Spirit will make known the wisdom of God. That's what Paul wrote. And there's only two ways, and they're exactly opposite. Let's turn to James 3, as James describes and compares two types of wisdom. Two types of wisdom. James 3, verse 13. And this is an excellent section here to review over and over again. Because it's very easy, and I'll talk about this in a moment, very easy to kind of caught up in what James calls the earthly wisdom. And there is a wisdom, how to get ahead, how to promote yourself, how to be on top, how to, you know, do certain things. And it's very easy to fall back to that, because it's really, we grew up, we were born into that's the way the world works. But we're being called out to be different, as we'll see. But let's go to James 3, verse 13. James 3, verse 13. And read what James writes here. Who is wise and understanding among you? He's asking a question. Who is wise and understanding among you? And if it's any of us, let's see what he says. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. The meekness of wisdom. Let's just pause here for a moment. James asks a question. And he's going to contrast two different wisdoms. And he's asking, who is wise with understanding? And he says, look at their good life or their works or their deeds done. Is it done with meekness or gentleness? A wisdom that does not harm anybody else or can cause hurt. It's a starting point of meekness. Very different than what we see. Most people who claim to be wise outside the church, especially outside the church, as to say, you know, they're not starting from a place of meekness and gentleness. And James goes on to show two different types of wisdom and where they come from. So let's keep going on verse 14, and he goes on. And he's on contrast, two different ways, two different wisdoms. Verse 14, but if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. So here we see a wisdom. It's called a wisdom, not from God. It's called earthly, sensual, and demonic. The philosophy of Satan, as we'll see. And he starts off by saying, bitter envy. Bitter envy is sometimes translated as bitter jealousness. Jealousness. Bitter envy. And these are strong emotions and feelings against others that lead to conflict. When people really envy somebody, want something, you might say it's a jealousy. You know, those are strong emotions that just reside there, and it leads to conflict. And we can look at the very first murder. The very first murder, Cain was envious that God respected Abel's offerings. And it just bothered him. And it bothered him, you know, that he was, and God gave Cain the answer what to do, but it just bothered him so much. He was envious of this, you know, and the thought is that Cain was older, and it just bothered him that he was envious. And what did he do? He killed his brother. It bothered him so much he led to murder, murdering his own brother, the first two brothers in the Bible. What else does James talk about? Self-seeking, or as some translations have it, selfish ambitions, which is the opposite of gentleness and meekness. Expositors add some color on this word self-seeking and says this term speaks of a self-seeking attitude bent on gaining an advantage and prestige for oneself or one's group. Self-seeking. Or selfish zeal. There's zeal, but it's selfish. It's for yourself. I mean, people have lots of zeal for their self. And they're willing to put energy time, thoughts into how to have, you know, whatever they want. Self-seeking, selfish zeal. And this is described as not from above, not from God, or from God, but earthly, sensual, and demonic. And we know the source of this type of wisdom by reading Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14. These two chapters provide a biography of being, of the being, biography of the being turned against God's way and developed a different way, different thought process, different philosophy, different motivation. I think you might have gone through this recently with Mr. Hewitt, but let's turn to Ezekiel 28, verse 15, Ezekiel 28, and we'll see this described here, this attitude, this selfishness, where why James rightly calls it a demonic wisdom. And where does it come from? Ezekiel 28, verse 15, and I'm going to read from the NIV. It says, "You are blameless in your ways." He's talking about Satan. You're describing Satan. You are blameless. On this point, it's Lucifer. "You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till wickedness or iniquity was found in you. Through your widespread trade or commerce, you were filled with violence and you sinned." Interesting that you were sinned. You know, when, you know, sin is the transgression of God's law. It's on 1 John 3:4. A sin. You started breaking, you know, God's eternal law, way of, and sinned. And so it says, "So I drove you in disgrace from the mount of God, and I expelled you, guardian cherub, from the fiery stones. Your heart became proud on account of your beauty." And look what it says right here. "And you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor." A corrupted wisdom. A wisdom, but corrupted. Impure. Polluted wisdom. Feelings and thoughts of envy developed. And a corrupted wisdom developed. And this wisdom led him to believe, Lucifer became Satan. He wanted, and the envy was so strong, and the jealousy and the corruptness of this wisdom was so strong that he wanted to be above God. And we read that in Isaiah 14. You don't have to turn there, but I'll read it to you. Isaiah 14, you read where Lucifer came to the point, is brought out here in verse 13, It says, "For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God." This is a corrupted wisdom developed in the mind of Lucifer. And he determines to be against God. He wants to be above God. James, when speaking of wisdom that is self-seeking and with bitter envy, he knows the source. He's telling us the source. When you see self-seeking and bitter envy, the source is demonic, not from God, not from God. A corrupted wisdom, as we read in Ezekiel 28. Now let's look at a different wisdom that's not corrupt, not corrupt. He goes on in James 3. Let's go back to James if you have your finger there, or I'll give you a moment to turn there. James, back to James 3, and we'll pick it back up at verse 17. So James describes what is this earthly corrupted, demonic, self-seeking wisdom, earthly, sensual, wherever there's confusion. And if you look around and there's confusion somewhere in the news, you can guess where what their origins are. Some kind of self-seeking motivation is causing that confusion. James 3, verse 17, James writes, "But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy." So let's go through this. This is a very excellent list describing God's wisdom, you know, the wisdom from above. First of all, it says the wisdom is above is first pure. First pure. As expositor says, this is the absence of any sinful attitude or motive. You know, it's the opposite of self-seeking. You know, it's a wisdom that doesn't have alternative motives. You know, we always sometimes we see people, what's the motive that really is behind what they want to do? These are pure, the pure motives. It's not corrupted, it's pure, without guile. You might say without guile. You know, just wisdom is pure. Next, he goes and says, a wisdom that's peaceable. Now, this is a mindset that leads to mutually positive outcomes, where everyone involved, wisdom is involved. Everybody is at peace. How things have occurred, how things transpire, how things get organized, how things go forward. There's peace. There's a wisdom that produces peace, where there isn't, anger or, people feeling there's an injustice occurring. There's peaceable. It's peaceable. Next, it says gentle. Gentle, which reflects a sensitivity towards others and their feelings. You're gentle. I think of gentle, and I was trying to think how will we, sometimes we aren't very gentle with one another, even in the church, or others we love, or even people. But how would, gentle. A way to think of this, a way to describe this, is how would you pick up a butterfly? See a butterfly, and maybe it's hurt, or needs to be picked up and moved somewhere. How would you pick up a butterfly? If you're not gentle, you're going to crush the butterfly. That'd be very sad. But you have to have a gentleness with something like a butterfly and just being able to be very gentle, pick it up. Or maybe it's like a crystal glass. I broke a glass just yesterday. It wasn't crystal, but it was a nice glass. Because I wasn't being very gentle. You have to be gentle, or you break things, or you hurt things, you crush things like a butterfly. Being gentle with others, that's the wisdom, being gentle with one another. How we approach one another. And sometimes we can, not be gentle, but being gentle. That's the way, wisdom from above is. It says, willing to yield. Willing to yield. This is a great one. Willing to yield. It means open to other people's perspectives. It doesn't mean wrong ideas necessarily, but different perspectives. And hear and possibly accept their preference on things. Yielding to others. Not forcing your preference on others, but willing to say, okay, to your spouse, let's go have Italian food versus your favorite Mexican food, whatever it may be. Where do you want to go? Maybe telling your spouse or a loved one or somebody that you maybe go to the feast with. Where would you like to go to the feast? Maybe you want to go to Jekyll Island, and they want to go to Branson. I hit a nerve. I know. Anyway, but how is willing to yield, right? Willing to yield. Is it like, well, it's going to be my way or the highway? Well, willing to yield. Well, maybe we could just go to whatever the preferences of the other person is. That's what it's willing to yield. It isn't always two people or maybe groups or people, whatever it may be. There's two different thoughts. Both are okay. Nothing wrong with either one. But willing to yield to the other person's preference. Going to Branson instead of Jekyll Island. Going to an Italian restaurant versus a Mexican restaurant. Or these are just sort of basic examples, but it could be like that's the type of thing. Willing to yield. Willing to do things one way versus another way. Sometimes, even in the church, you organize things, put chairs a certain way. Maybe there's two different ways to set up chairs. Or put food out. Or whatever it may be. And both opinions are good. Well, how do you, are one or both people willing to yield? Well, maybe we'll do it this way. Okay, I can see how that would work. That's what willing to yield means. Next, James puts full of mercy, which means not quick to condemn or judge or think something negative in the sense of you're doing something wrong. It's an approach that considers God's mercy and grace received in response to others, being merciful. What does Hosea 6:6 say? And Jesus Christ himself quotes this, talking to the Pharisees. He says, "For I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings." The point is, God puts a big weight on mercy. Being merciful to one another. Giving each other a little bit of break. Okay. Not quick to condemn. Being full of mercy. Next, he says, good fruits. Good fruits. The wisdom that leads to positive outcomes and results. Good fruits. But fruit is what is produced. If you apply wisdom a certain way, what's the outcome? Are good fruits or bad fruits? Well, Galatians 5, which we heard in the sermonette, we'll read them again. Galatians 5 is, and the fruit of the Spirit. Here is a way that produces good fruit. Good fruit is described here in Galatians 5. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. These are all descriptions of good fruit from God's Spirit, from God's wisdom, a godly wisdom being applied. There isn't, as we heard, confusion. There's confusion prevalent in the situation, stirring up confusion and problems. That's not God's wisdom, but it has good, peaceable outcomes. The fruits of the Spirit are there. It's enjoyable. There's joy, there's peace, there's kindness. Next, James goes on and says, without partiality. Now, this word here, the Greek word that's translated as partiality, is only used once in the Bible. But it means an unwavering approach or without any uncertainty. It means there's no doubt or no lack of faith in the right way to do things. You're not double-minded. Okay, this is the right way to do things. Being confident in God's approach and not double-minded or without doubt. Not conflicted in the spirit of God's way and applying God's wisdom. And it's equally applied to everybody. That's the term of partiality. Equally applied to everybody. Not to some people, not your friends, not to the rich person, not to the other person. It's to everybody. Equally applied. God's wisdom equally applied without, and that's what that word means. Then he goes on and says, without hypocrisy, without hypocrisy. Insincerity means living only, living one way, but putting on an act, like a skilled actor or an actress. You can become different in situations and put on different face or different approach or act differently. So it's not a counterfeit or an approach. It means not just, you have a false humility, how you have a wisdom that appears so like a godly wisdom, but in reality it's not. It's a false humility or false kindness. All this is done without hypocrisy. It's really how you are, how wisdom is being applied, without hypocrisy. Not a counterfeit an approach, not a false gentleness or mercy, but genuine. So we see James here describing the two wisdoms and the motivations and the results. Now, we describe these two wisdoms. James does a very good job. He went through with a little bit of detail of each one and described what it's meant by these two wisdoms. Let's go back now to the church and bring it back to where we started, back to the church and the wisdom that is to be made known by the church, the ones that are called out from the wisdom of this world into the wisdom of God. Within the church, we should live by the wisdom from above, or we should be trying to do that. It's not something we work on. God has given us the blessing of His Spirit to understand the mind of God. So God's Spirit does begin to understand the mind of God, the wisdom of God, and to apply and live by the wisdom of God. That's what God's Spirit does, helps us with. We reviewed what the meekness of wisdom is and the qualities of godly wisdom from above. Let's talk about how this in the church context, This is the way we are to interact with one another, wisdom that we all should be developing in how we work with one another. It's not easy to do that at times. It's not easy. If we're honest, it's not always easy to do that. Part of the reason why is that the wisdom of this world has been so ingrained in us, and that's in how we need to operate, how we need to survive even sometimes in this world, to get ahead or to move forward in whatever job or situation we're in. So ingrained. And then we get stressed or we feel threatened. And what do? We fall back into familiar ways. We fall back to this way it worked. And there is a wisdom of where the wisdom of this world works in a certain context that we're familiar with. Sometimes we see this, we see others. Sometimes we have a long history in the church. We see others in the church who seem to be operating this way, with respect to the wisdom of the world. And we feel motivated sometimes to operate the same way. But it takes faith. It really takes faith to live by the meekness of the wisdom of God. And that's what we're to do. We're to live by godly wisdom in our lives and towards each other based on love. It means we live this way even if others are not doing it, if those around us are not doing it, and trusting in God, godly wisdom. The wisdom of God is being developed in the church. And the church is special to God. The church are the one in the church, the church are the individuals, the ones who are developing the wisdom of God. A way that starts with loving God with all their hearts and loving others. A way of cooperation, service, humility, gentleness, and kindness, and mercy to others. The called out ones know this way leads to peace. For eternity. Think about it. We're going to be in eternity forever and ever. 1 million years from now, 5 million years from now, 1 billion years. And God's going to have godly wisdom that produces peace and mercy and cooperation. Now, how did Paul express it? The manifold wisdom of God might be known by the church to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. Think about it. What is he saying here? He's saying, you see, Satan doesn't think it's possible that we wouldn't be self-oriented, looking to put ourselves first. He's saying Satan and his angels are seeing it demonstrated in the church on his domain. Where are we at? Well, this is really still Satan's domain, his home court. It's really a statement being saying, you know, it's really a very big statement being made here that's being made by Paul. He's saying essentially, yes, just like Christ was born and lived on your turf, talking about Satan, and overcame your ideas and your philosophy, I'm going to build my church on your own turf. And they will show that God's kingdom, based on love and the gift way of life, is possible for all eternity in the flesh, with God's Spirit, of course, on your turf. Hebrews 2:5 says that God has put the world to come, not put the world to come in subjection to angels. Who is it going to be given to? The church under Christ. The first fruits are special to God. The church is special to God. As part of the ecclesia, let's continue to grow in the grace and knowledge, continue to endure to the end, and let the wisdom of God be seen in us as we look forward to the wonderful promises to the church. God's promise is to raise up the ecclesia together and made us sit together in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, that in ages to come he might show us the exceedingly riches and heavenly places in Christ Jesus. It's a wonderful calling. The ecclesia of the church is special to Christ and God, and we are showing right now in Satan's domain, you might say, that we can live the wisdom of the wisdom of above, God's wisdom, which is contrary to everything around us, and it's being shown to the spiritual realm of this world that yes, it can be done. Brethren, appreciate being the church. We've got an incredible calling, and we'll talk about more of that as we get closer to Pentecost. But it's a wonderful blessing to be in the church of God. It's a wonderful blessing to have God's Spirit, and we have a wonderful future ahead of us.